Genesis 35 to 36, the 34th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 24, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to look at a couple of chapters of Genesis today. We're going to try to bring ourselves to a nice stopping point. We're going to look at chapters 35 and 36. 35 just finishes up the story of Jacob. It's just kind of finishing up some details, really, I think. Then 36 is the genealogy of Esau, and we will just glance at that. I will spare you. Now, in chapter 35, it's not really a fluid narrative. For the past several chapters, we've had a very fluid narrative where it's describing a situation and developing it. Here, it's just snippets of things that have been piled on at the end of Jacob's story. And there are, as a result, some very puzzling insertions into this section, and we'll look at those. And in chapter 36, there are some very confusing genealogical conundrums, which I will also deftly avoid. But all of this is, as you can imagine, fertile ground for the higher textual critics, but I won't get into that either. Last time, where we left off, the sons of Jacob had sought their revenge on the people of Shechem. They, on their own initiative, had gone into the city of Shechem and killed all of the males in the city in vengeance for the rape of their sister. Jacob, meanwhile, had done nothing in response to this act. The sons were the ones who did this, and after they had done this, Jacob said, "Why did you do this? Because now all of the people of the land will attack us, and there are too many of them for us to defend ourselves against them." And the son's response was, "But he raped her." And Jacob had no comeback for that. So they, after having killed all of the men of Shechem, they go in and they collect all of the wealth of Shechem, all the livestock, all the servants, and they take all of that away and merge that with their household wealth. And that's where we pick up the action in chapter 35. We'll read the first 8 verses. "Then God said to Jacob, 'Arise, go up to Bethel and live there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau.' So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, 'Put away the foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourself, and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone.' So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had, and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem." Once again, Jacob is not quick to take action. Jacob kind of lets things happen and sits back and lets things happen. And when difficult things come along and happen, he doesn't know how to respond. He doesn't know what to do. And in this situation, God says, rise up and go. And there have been other times when Jacob has been directed to do something. He kind of waits and doesn't take initiative. He allows other people to tell him what to do. And God says, rise up and go. Go to a different place. Go to Bethel. If you will recall, Bethel was the place where he spent the night when he was first fleeing from Esau. And that's where God appeared to him and told him that he, God, would take care of Jacob on this journey and make sure that he made it to Haran safely and back safely. And Jacob had promised if God would do that, he would be his God, that Jacob would declare God his God. Well, now God is saying, rise up and go back to that place. So it's God is instructing him to complete his journey, complete his circuit. And he is to live there rather than, he had settled down in Shechem apparently for quite a number of years. And now he's told to go on to Bethel and live there. And he's told to build an altar. This is the only time that a patriarch has been specifically told to build an altar. And it's to be built to the God who appeared to him there. So God reminds him of the fact that he's the same God who had appeared to him at the beginning of the journey. It's kind of interesting that God hasn't, he makes no mention of any of the intervening events, intervening times that God has appeared to him. He just makes mention of that time way back when God had appeared to Jacob before he left for Haran. Jacob then, having received these instructions from God, he turns to his household and says, get rid of all the idols and cleanse yourselves. Put on new clothes. We are going to Bethel, to the place where God had appeared to me. Apparently, what Jacob has decided is what is necessary is a new start. We're going to start fresh. So let's wipe the slate clean. We are getting rid of all of these, all of the idols. The rings apparently had religious significance. And he's going to get rid of those. They're going to wash themselves and put on new clothes. It's a new start. So they bring all of these things to Jacob. And presumably there's more than just, we know that Rachel, when they had left Haran, had taken the terebinth, which were the household idols, and she had hidden them. So we know that at some point at least they had those. Whether those are still around or not is not clear. But apparently they have taken on other idols, and it's not clear when that happened. Have they, over the years that they have been living in Shechem, have they been accumulating these things? Or did they only take them when they plundered Shechem as part of the loot that they accumulated? It's not clear. But in any case, they found these things to be valuable enough to take into their possession. So they've got a number of household, they've got a number of idols, and they also have these rings that have religious significance. It could also be that the captives that they have taken have these rings and these idols. In any case, what has been requested is that they bring all of these to Jacob. Jacob collects them. He doesn't destroy them, which is curious, but he hides them, it says. He hides them under the oak tree. Now, it's not obvious what's happening here, but I think, reading between the lines, they've lived in Shechem for about 10 years, and what has just happened has demonstrated to Jacob that his sons, his family, they had moral outrage at what the people of Shechem did. So on the one hand, they've kept a certain measure of separation culturally between themselves and the people who live in Shechem. But on the other hand, they have accumulated these idols and the rings. So there's been a certain amount of enculturation, assimilation that has taken place. And I think, looking back at the incident with Dinah, that her actions probably betray a certain amount of cultural assimilation as well. She went out as a female girl alone into the city in a way that was not proper. I think that that's what the language is indicating. She has become a member of the local culture, in a sense. And the rest of the family has apparently assimilated some of the culture as well. So Jacob, now looking at what has happened, has decided what we need is a fresh start. We need to renounce the amount of cultural assimilation that has taken place, start fresh, go elsewhere, and reconstruct our lives in a way that's free from the cultural influences around us. So that's what they do. They get rid of all the idols and the rings. They're buried under the oak tree, and they depart and head to Bethel. And as they're going, God protects them. Remember, Jacob's concern was, now the people of the land will be outraged and they will all gang up on us and attack us. But in fact, what has happened is God has instilled in them a great fear of Jacob and his family. And that has been protective. So God has protected them in spite of their foolishness. They arrive at Bethel. Jacob does what God had told him to do. He builds an altar and he names it El Bethel, the God of Bethel, thereby claiming the God who had made those promises to him and who had kept those promises to him 20-30 years earlier. Now he is proclaiming him to be his God, just as Jacob said that he would. Then we have the first of the very mysterious insertions into the text. Verse 8, now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the oak. It was named Alon Bakuth. That's curious, because how does that fit into the narrative? There's been only one mention of Deborah prior to this. Deborah was given to Rebekah as a servant, I think by Laban. So presumably she traveled with Rebekah back to Canaan. And then when Rebekah was married to Isaac, she continued to be a servant to Rebekah. And there has been no mention of her since then. And now this is stuck in here. There is a curious feature to the narrative that may explain this insertion, and that is there's been no mention of Rebekah's death. Apparently, Rebekah died while Jacob was gone, which is interesting because Rebekah had sent Jacob away in order to save him, and in so doing had made it so that she could not see him again. Presumably she never saw him again. There's no mention of Rebekah's death, so apparently it happened while Jacob was gone. So it's possible that this insertion of Deborah here is kind of an oblique way of recalling Rebekah reminding us of Rebekah and draw attention to the fact that she is no longer in the narrative, that she must be gone. So that's one possible explanation. The other possible explanation is that this is some kind of an allusion to an oral tradition about Deborah that it would have been well known to the readers, but which has been lost to us. Apparently, Deborah was a beloved figure, because the place where she's buried is called the Oak of Weeping. So presumably, she is a significant and beloved feature, character in their legends, but that legend has been lost to us. So those are the two plausible explanations that I came across. I really don't know why Deborah is mentioned here. It is rather strange. Now, God appears and proclaims a blessing on Jacob. We'll read that in the next six verses. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." Thus he called him Israel. God also said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. And the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you. And I will give the land to your descendants after you." Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured out a libation on it. He also poured oil on it. So Jacob named the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. So God appears to him, and he does two things. One, he reaffirms the renaming of Jacob. He is no longer Jacob, heel grabber, but now he is Israel, he who wrestles with God, he who struggles with God. So he reaffirms that name change that had taken place originally during the wrestling match that Jacob had had with the angel just before he met, was reconciled with Esau. Then he blesses him, and the blessing that he proclaims is very similar to the blessing that was originally given to Abraham. He says, "I am God Almighty, El Shaddai," which is the same name that he had used when he originally spoke to Abraham. He says that he will be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come forth from you. So not just a nation, but a nation full of, and I think the idea here is tribes, will come forth from you, and kings will come forth from you. Similar statements, not identical, but similar statements had been given to Abraham the first time that God spoke to Abraham. And he goes on to say that the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you and your descendants after you. So he's reaffirming that Jacob is the heir of the promises that had been given originally to Abraham, had been reiterated to Isaac. Now Jacob is the sole inheritor of those very same promises. So Jacob sets up a pillar of stone. This is the second time he's set up a pillar of stone. He had put up a pillar of stone the first time he had been at Bethel and God had spoken to him. And he pours out oil on it in some kind of consecrating ceremony, apparently. And he names this place Bethel, the house of God. Now the next section where they make their trip from Bethel to Bethlehem. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. And it came about when she was in severe labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for now you are now you have another son." And it came about as her soul was departing for she died, that she named him Benoni. But his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar over her grave. That is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it came about when Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So they've moved on from Bethel. They're headed towards Bethlehem. And en route to Bethlehem, Rachel goes into labor. And it's severe labor. And it must be very severe because Rachel seems to be despairing. She seems to be to the point where she can't take it anymore. And the midwife, trying to encourage her, says, "Don't fear, because you've given birth to another son." So trying to encourage her and help her through her pain and agony. But Rachel does not survive this birth. Rachel dies, and as she's dying, she names the son, and she names the son, "Son of my sorrow," trying to record this moment in history, in a sense. Then she dies. And Jacob then doesn't want this son to carry that name for his life. He renames the son. And he renames the son Benjamin, which means son of good fortune. He turns it just around. Rather than son of sorrow, it's son of good fortune. Then he buries Rachel at this place in Ephrath. This is curious, and I think a particularly sad moment. Rachel had once said to Jacob, if you will recall, when she was in this contest with Leah to see who would produce offspring for Jacob, she had turned to Jacob and she said, "Give me children or else I die." And she got children and died in the process. She had her first child, Joseph, and named him Add Another. She had another, but she died in the process of giving birth to that second one. Benjamin is distinctive in a number of ways from the other sons. He's the only son born in Canaan. He is the only son who ends up being named by his father. He is the last of the sons that are born. And he turns out to be one of his father's two favorites, the other being Joseph. So it's a sad and kind of perplexing event here in the narrative of Jacob. Then we have a bizarre little reference. Well, Jacob erects a pillar then over Rachel's grave, which it says stands to this day. Then they moved further and went to a place called Tower of Eder, which means Tower of the Flocks. But then we've got this second strange insertion into the text. And it came about while Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. We have nothing more is recorded about this particular incident. It could be that what we have here is incest, in a sense. It is Reuben having sexual relations with his father's concubine. So it could be that we just have an instance of immorality once again, a display of the children of Jacob showing that they do not embrace the values that have been passed down through the family. But there could be something more significant happening here, and I suspect that that's the case. Later on in the history of Israel, there are a couple of instances where a son has sexual relations with his father's concubines. And we know in later history that is a significant thing for a son to do. It's not just sexual immorality, it's making a claim on the household. That by doing that act, the son is claiming the father's household for his own. So it's a very significant thing that's being done. It's not just sexual immorality. Well, this is much earlier than those later acts where we know that that's the significance of the act. But I suspect that that significance is here as well. Jacob has shown that he is kind of an absentee father and an absentee husband. He hasn't been deeply engaged in the life of his family. And we saw with the rape of his daughter, his reaction was almost non-existent. And so the son stepped in to the void, to fill the void of leadership, of moral leadership. And I suspect that what has happened here is Reuben is making his claim to the household now in the absence of Jacob showing good leadership. He thinks that this is an opportune time for him to make such a play, a power play. And notice, once again, it says, and Israel heard of it, but there's no response. Jacob doesn't know what to do in the face of these kinds of family struggles and problems. But later on, at the end of Genesis, when Jacob on his deathbed proclaims the blessings on his sons, it is interesting to note, as I pointed out last week, that Levi and Simeon, he curses their anger because of the vengeance that they had sought for their sister, the rape of their sister. But he also proclaims a curse on Reuben for this particular act of sleeping with Jacob's concubine. So the three oldest sons are all disinherited in the end. And it is Judah, his fourth son, that then Jacob says, the kings will come from you. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, is what he says in chapter 49. So Jacob does eventually act on what Reuben has done, but at the time that it happens, it just says that Israel heard of it. There's no indication of a response. Okay, the rest of this chapter, I'll read it. Now there were 12 sons of Jacob, the sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, then Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin, and the sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, Dan and Naphtali, and the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maid, Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. This section once again lists for us the sons of Jacob. It lists them not in order in which they were born, but it goes through and lists all of the sons of Leah first, then the sons of Rachel, then the sons of Rachel's concubine, then the sons of Leah's concubine. Then says that Israel goes on and finally returns to Mamre, or Hebron, where he had originally departed from his family. Now he rejoins them finally. And that's where Isaac presumably had been living out his years. Now, this is apparently not in chronological order. I don't remember all of the verses, but if you work out the math, Isaac dies at the age of 180 years. And I think that means that he died 10 years after Joseph was sold into slavery. So Isaac has seen all of this stuff happen, and then he finally dies at 180 years of age. So this is not in chronological order. Isaac lived a long time. And interestingly, both Esau and Jacob were present there at the burial when Isaac died. So there has been apparently significant reconciliation and lasting reconciliation that has happened between Esau and Jacob. This section then, for all intents and purposes, concludes the narrative with respect to Jacob. Jacob is mentioned later on in the text, but the focus shifts from Jacob now to his son Joseph. And the rest of Genesis is really devoted to telling that story, the story of Joseph. So let me stop here and make just a few comments on Jacob's life. Jacob had a tough life. If you think back to the narrative that we've gone through with respect to Jacob, there is very little in it that is cause for joy. He had a lot of tough experiences. And in particular, if you look at his experiences after he returns from Haran, it's one horrendous thing after the other. Virtually unbroken sorrow, except possibly the birth of Benjamin. But even that is mixed. So Jacob has had a tough life. When later on in the Joseph narrative, when the Pharaoh asked Jacob how old he is, Jacob tells him how old he is, and then he says, few and painful have been the days of my life. Let me see if I can get it right. Few and unpleasant have been the days of my life. So his life has been full of sorrow. And in fact, as we go on, there's more sorrow yet for him to experience. He's an interesting character. He's not painted in an extremely positive light, and his life is not a wonderful life. It's not the kind of thing that we would want to replicate. As I've mentioned before, he is good at what he does. He's a good shepherd. He's good at raising livestock and has become wealthy as a result of his expertise. But he's got a lot of flaws. He has inherited the deceitfulness that seems to run in his family. He is a practitioner of it. He has been overwhelmed, as I think is the best way of expressing it, as a husband and a father to multiple wives and a number of sons. And he seems to get into these situations in his domestic life where he just doesn't know what to do. He's paralyzed and doesn't know how to respond. And as a result, it appears to me that he has abdicated his moral leadership. He's created a vacuum in his family. And his sons then begin to challenge him for control of the household. So he's a very flawed human being who has lived a very difficult life. But I think beneath it all, he is genuinely a man of faith. Faith did not come easily for him. It was a struggle. It was a long time before he reached the place where he could trust God. But I think that in the narrative we see that he comes to trust God profoundly. And in particular, in the incident where he wrestles with the angel of God, I think that captures that point in time when he realized that his struggle was not ultimately with other people. Because prior to that, he had tended to see his struggle as with other people. It was trying to manipulate and to con people and to maneuver in order to protect his own self-interests. But in that wrestling match, that wrestling match captures a point in time in which he realized ultimately what he was struggling with and wrestling with was not other people, but it was God himself. And having come to that realization, he holds on desperately to God and wants what God has for him. He realizes that is what's critical. Not maneuvering and getting what he wants, but rather holding tightly to God and begging God to bless him with whatever God has to bless him with. Because that's the source of true fulfillment, and that's the source of life. So I think Jacob comes to the place where he really understands that. And that's the essence of faith, is that holding on to God dearly for what God has to give us. Nevertheless, so he's a flawed man, but I think he's a man of faith. And even apart from that, unquestionably, he is the man that God chose. Esau and Jacob were twins. Esau happened to come out first. But it was clearly God who picked Jacob to be the inheritor of the promises. And I think we see that very clearly in the narrative, that there's a sense in which Jacob thought that he had maneuvered to get the inheritance and to get the blessing. But in fact, that's what God had intended right from the beginning. Jacob was going to be the one to inherit those promises. Which means that it was a conscious decision on God's part to make Jacob the foundation stone from which God produced his chosen people. What a bizarre stone to choose. You would think that God would choose this pillar of faith, this man who is free of flaws, but in fact it's quite the contrary. This is a man for whom faith came hard, life is tough, and is full of flaws. And it is interesting that of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as the way they're presented in the narrative, Abraham seems to struggle the least. For him, faith comes relatively easily. For Isaac, it's a little harder. For Jacob, it's downright difficult. And yet it is Jacob who is renamed Israel, and the one after whom the descendants then get their name. We don't call them Abrahamites. We call them Israelites. And I think that the reason is because there's this feature of Jacob's character that becomes the feature of the people as a whole. And that is, their whole history has been one of wrestling with God. Their whole history has been trying to come to terms with what it means to be chosen and blessed by God and to be a people here on this earth, and they have struggled mightily with that. And I suspect the reason they've been called Israelites is because of that feature of their character. There's a sense in which, however, they have struggled with that as a nation, but we as believers struggle with coming to terms with God as well. Every one of us carries on that wrestling match with God. If we are granted the wisdom to understand that that is with whom we have to do this wrestling match. Some people never realize that their wrestling match is with God. They think it's with circumstances and other people. But those of us who have been blessed with the understanding that it is indeed with God, that primarily we are wrestling, that's a true blessing. And hopefully God will bring us to the understanding that we need to hold on to Him tightly and want what He has for us. And that whatever He has for us, that is the source of life. The next chapter, 36, I will not even read. It is the genealogy of Esau. So the text here breaks off. We have concluded the story of Jacob. Now it wraps up that whole generation by giving the genealogy of Esau. And then this is the last that we hear of Esau in Genesis, is this chapter. And as I have pointed out before, I think that Esau is if you look at him as a whole in Genesis, he is quite a noble character as he emerges in the text. He learned a lot in his life and came a long ways. And I think became a man of faith. I think that's what we're to understand. Okay. So I won't even read that. We will stop here. Any comments or questions?
I'm curious, in chapter 35, verses 21 and 22, the narrator refers to Jacob as Israel, mm-hmm. whereas it seems like just about, well, at least surrounding it, he refers to Jacob.
Yes.
In Abraham's case, after God changed his name, it stays to Abraham.
Yes.
Why this wavering? Do you have any clue?
I don't know. Okay. In fact, I haven't counted up, but he is almost always referred to as Jacob, even through the rest of the text in Genesis. He is rarely referred to as Israel. I don't know why that is. That doesn't mean it's not significant. I think it is significant. I just haven't figured out what it is. But I think there is a method to the madness. I think there is a reason why one name is used as opposed to the other. Sorry.
I really like what you said about Jacob not being this sterling, perfect, simple character. It's very complicated. And so in the context of that, I'm wondering, what do you think it means to cling to God when you're wrestling with Him?
Well, the wrestling that takes place is just trying to find our way through situations in which we do that which is right and which is ultimately good. Apart from God's wisdom, what we're always doing is trying to figure out how to get what we want in the short term. We're very short-sighted and don't have perspective on things. I think what it means to cling to God is to seriously, deep down in our hearts, to really want that which God wants. And it's a matter of struggling. We play a lot of games with ourselves and do a lot of self-deception. And it's a matter of realizing that that is what we do, and to try to dig down deeper and say, but do I really want what God wants? And as deep as we can dig down, try to make sure that at that point, the answer is settled. Yes, I want what God wants. That I value what God values. And I realize that real life, real fulfillment can only come from Him.
David, this is a background generalization question about Genesis, not a specific one about today's presentation. Would you take a minute and remind me again, what's the nature of the text from which we're reading? That is historical narrative, epic. What's the background, as I know you have studied it for a long time, to put it in context about from what are we reading?
Well, it... that was put together by, traditionally it's ascribed to Moses, and that's, I think that's as good a guess as we have, that Moses, who was, as you will recall, schooled in Egypt, where, and he would have been schooled with the princes of Egypt, and at that time in Egyptian history, the Egyptians had a habit of taking the princes of the kings in Palestine and Canaan, and taking those princes hostage, in a sense, took them down to Egypt and schooled them there in the house of the Pharaoh. So Moses was raised in that environment. And I assume Moses had access to a large number of sources. Sources, I assume, oral sources that had come down through his family, and also written sources that were available there in Egypt. And as a good historian, he has put together, as best he can, and I think through the inspiration of God, a narrative which tells the history of what God has been doing in this world. What is this world for? Who is God? And what is He up to in this world? And so the first 11 chapters of Genesis really focus on that relationship between God and man. Who is God, and what kind of creature is man, and what is the interaction between them? Then it picks up in chapter 11 with Abraham, and God, it's as if God is coming in and saying, I have a solution for the problem of man. And He picks out Abraham and says, I'm going to bless you. And what we see then is God entering into human history, and He takes a man, and He takes him from faithlessness to faith. And He makes him someone who really embraces the values of God in the way that you don't see people before Abraham as a whole doing, that man's nature is contrary, is rebellious against God. And then we see the descendants of Abraham, God going to work in the lives of each one of them and doing the same thing, taking them from faithlessness to faith. So I think what we're seeing is God's solution to the problem then. This is how God is going to make man an obedient creature, one who embraces the values of God. And this is just part of that narrative. And in doing that, he also brings into existence a nation that's going to be serve a unique role in human history. And that nation is going to uniquely display the truths of God through the way it conducts itself and through its laws and through its prophecies. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. That was right on to what I was asking. At the same time that Moses is writing, what might be an example of contemporary literature or writing, contemporary history? What's he's living in a pagan environment, mm-hmm. and he's writing biblical presentation.
Yes.
How does he get away with it?
Well, there would have been other histories. What he's writing is not dramatically different in genre from other things that existed. In fact, there are stories that are similar to parts of Genesis that are found in Egyptian culture as well as Mesopotamian culture. And some of those we have, and you can read them. But if you put them side by side, there is a qualitative difference. I think there is a demonstrable qualitative difference. There is a weightiness and a clarity of perspective on human existence, the way life really is, that is manifested here in Genesis that you don't see in the works of the surrounding culture. But you can read and see.
Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that you might have covered when I was gone, and mm-hmm. if so, just tell me and I'll get the tape.
Okay.
Your description of Jacob wrestling with the angel and him coming to an understanding that God was whom he had to do with and not other people, and what he was going to do with God was the issue, is helpful to me. I come from a tradition years ago, before being here, that their perception of that, their interpretation of that, I think, if I am understanding correctly, would be that Jacob prevailed upon the angel, he prevailed with the angel, he prevailed on God. It's similar to their idea that God's will for you is available, but you must appropriate it. It is a different idea of what God's sovereignty looks like, not just that your wrestling and your decisions are a working out of who you really are and what you really want, but that you are the creator of your future in a way that is different than I would understand it now. Not that it's our decisions don't matter, but so could you talk about the difference between that idea of I'm supposed to, which is not unsimilar to the people who worshipped multiple gods, that I kind of had to work right. everybody and to get what I wanted.
Right. Well, it seems to me that one of the strong themes of Genesis is that God is in control of everything, and that's woven into the text, and I think is one of the things that Genesis wants to bring out. So, for instance, Jacob, at the time of birth, it was declared that the younger would rule over the older. And what we see happening is Jacob, early in his life, has that, the other perspective that you were talking about. He has the perspective that life is of my own making, and I'm going to shape it to my wishes. And what becomes apparent as you go through his life is he's just created a mess for himself. That in fact he can't form life to his liking. He is powerless to do so, ultimately. And that behind the scenes, God has been working all the time. And as Jacob gets older, it's as if Jacob has, in his younger life, has been doing all of these things and thinking he has accomplished a lot and thinking he has made a lot of progress towards making life the way he wants it. But as Jacob gets older, it's like God emerges from behind, and you can see that God was active throughout. And in fact, God continues to be active in a way that Jacob is powerless to do. And I think that's what Jacob came to realize, is that it was not him. Even with the manipulations of the livestock, the way that he was going to make sure that he got a higher percentage of the livestock than would ordinarily happen, he thought he was being very clever. But I think what the text is indicating is he ran out of tricks, and yet he continued to prosper. Why? Because God was doing it, and he came to realize that God was the one who had been doing it all along. So I think one of the themes here is that it is ultimately not possible for us to do that kind of manipulation. We can't pin God. That's really ludicrous in light of the rest of the text to think that Jacob could pin God if God did not will to be pinned.
It's sad that sometimes the move from I'm going to manipulate those people around me to like, oh, wait a minute, it's God I have to do with, is not like, okay, God is sovereign and I have to deal with him and wrestle right. with, do I want what he wants and is it okay with me? But it's just a move from I need to manipulate these people to, okay, I need to manipulate God.
That's right. Yeah, but I really think that's antithetical to the picture that's being painted here of God in general. It really is. Okay, one more question.
Real quick, it seems like through Genesis, the Jews equate the presence of God with the blessing of God. His presence with, be it cattle, be it whatever, and that seems to be a natural human inclination, is to equate the presence of God with some type of material reality. I know Jesus, you know, blasted that one apart, but where... maybe that was God's M.O., or maybe that was a misconstrued understanding on the part of the Jews about God and about God's presence. You want to comment on that?
Well, as you look at the narrative, I think it is the case that the wealth of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was due to the blessing of God.
Presence of God. Yeah, God is with me. There, because I'm
right.
blessed, therefore God is with me.
Right. The way I think what's happening there is it's not that having wealth is of ultimate value, but that it is something that communicates. So God blessed the patriarchs, I think, most significantly, with a spiritual blessing. He brought them to the place where they realized who God was, and they realized their need for God.
That's the really significant blessing that each of these three patriarchs received. But with that came an inferior blessing in a sense, that is wealth. Why did God do that? I think as a visible sign of the invisible blessing that they actually received. That their wealth was a kind of blessing that communicated, that could be seen both by them and the people around them. So it's like a sign that these are the people that I have blessed. So I think that's what's going on. And I think God has continued to bless his people in that same way. That the people of Israel are uniquely blessed in that sense of being particularly gifted in important respects. Okay, this ends my turn teaching. Next week, Ron is going to, by popular demand, is going to repeat his talk on why he's a fundamentalist. Right? Yes. And then the week after that, Jack's going to begin a series on 1 John, right? Or First or something John. Okay. In one Sunday? Is that what you said?
Sure.
Well, when my next turn, I will pick up where I left off with Joseph and do the Joseph series. And then I'll be at the end of Genesis. And in one Sunday, I will pull it all together. The nice thing about doing it that way is it gives me more time before I have to pull it all together.